The trauma is usually about secrets, things happening to you that you're not able or allowed to talk about.
Dr. Bessel van der Kolk is a renowned researcher on trauma.
We need to be much more precise in our diagnoses. So what is bothering you? It's very hard to be mindful when your mind is on fire.
Welcome to The Genius of Wellness, a podcast brought to you by Hopkins Medical Group, serving patients in Greater Boston with a personalized approach to healthcare. Learn more at thegeniusofwellness.org. I'm Ted Canova. How do you move on from a horrible childhood experience? Is it even possible to detoxify your body from trauma? Settle in as Dr. van der Kolk discusses the nitty-gritty with Drs. Pat Hopkins and Steve Roberts. Pat, I just learned you had an incredible childhood trauma experience that dealt with almost drowning. Explain it to us.
Well, I was 6 years old at the beach with neighbors, and my parents weren't nearby. They had taken us for a weekend, my sister and I, and I'd just been learning to swim, and I'm standing at the edge of the water, and all of a sudden a wave came that was bigger than I was and just swept me out. And I remember being turned over and over again as I went out thinking, I've just learned to swim, and could I make it back in? Because there were riptides, and it was a very big, we used to call them big undertoads, but they were undertoads. We thought they were toads.
And what happened?
I survived. I was rescued. And it's interesting. I remember being pulled out, but I don't remember much after that, in fact.
When I asked you about, have you ever experienced a childhood trauma, this didn't come to mind immediately. And I think that this impacts a lot of people who have had early traumas. And to address this issue is one of the most renowned doctors in all the world, Bessel van der Kolk. Hi, Bessel.
Hi.
What does it tell you when you hear Pat's story that she didn't even remember that she had a childhood trauma at first?
I don't know what to make of that. You know, most childhood traumas really that leave an impact is more interpersonal traumas, that kids basically feel safe as long as the people who take care of them are there for them. And so a single incident like this would be momentarily extremely scary, but if people are there for you afterwards and they make you feel safe and they cuddle you, you're probably going to be okay. We are a very resilient species. The things that really messes it up if the people who we depend on for safety and security actually turn on us. So the fact that you almost drowned, they go like, oh, interesting. What effect did it have on you? Did you become afraid of the water? Did you continue to swim? And most likely, you did okay.
What's striking about trauma is that it's discovered and also forgotten.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
Yeah, but most part of trauma that leaves a real impact is interpersonal trauma, is really being hurt and molested and put down by people who you counted. Kids are very emotionally very tied up with their parents. And as long as their parents are sources of safety and predictability, they tend to do okay.
Well, let's go to a world event then, because you have such a history, born at the end of World War II. What did you learn in the aftermath of World War II when it came to your childhood?
Even that is dubious. I was certainly preoccupied with the war, but I'm one out of five siblings, and I'm the only one who has a deep preoccupation with trauma. So that doesn't explain it. These things are not linear. You know, I became fascinated by trauma probably because more that I always suspected that my mom had something terrible happen to her than anything else. And of course, the Second World War was an organizing principle of my mind, but so it was for many other people who never became trauma specialists. So
the trauma of our parents, can we inherit that trauma?
Oh, absolutely. If your parents become uptight, upset, nervous, freaked out, extremely angry about things that you don't understand and that you don't know where it comes from, one tends to get very preoccupied with trying to predict what your parents are going to do for you. And there's evidence on multiple levels that trauma really passes on from generation to generation, and that your epigenetic changes, your stress hormones change, depending on how your parents respond to you. And so if you have something bad happen to you as a kid, and your parents are always there for you, and they're calm, and they're quiet, you're going to be okay, by and large.
Bessel, it's surprising a little bit because Since you were born at the end of World War II, I had read that your father was in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
And that you barely survived, you have written.
That's true.
So you're saying that this unspeakable cruelty that you dealt with as a child didn't play into your life?
Well, it had an impact on me, but if you try to go there, you really are skating on very thin ice. I mean, I'm one out of five kids, and we all are very different, and we have different preoccupations, different professions, and you cannot, in a linear way, oh, he became this trauma expert because of what happened to him when he was 2 years old. No, most kids who grew up at the same time as I did not become trauma experts.
Do you think the ability to daydream, Franco writes about that, the survivors of the Holocaust were those that actually saw them themselves back in their safety of their home? Can a child heal themselves? How do they get healed?
We are an astoundingly resilient species. There's more of us. We have wiped out most other species. So we're made for survival, basically. Kids also survive unspeakable cruelties, which leaves their traces, but they're not predictable. They're not linear. You know, one kid have kind of similar experiences, and different kids come out in different ways. The capacity for imagination is enormously powerful. And I think what really liberates children is the ability to imagine other realities, other possibilities, other caregivers, fairy tales, books, movies, Harry Potter, creating Harry Potter in your mind is enormously powerful in terms of helping people to survive horrible things.
Fast forward, Bessel, to adulthood, where so many of us stuff some of the things that have happened in our past. Does everybody need to unearth that past, or is some of it just, should it just stay compartmentalized, or does it play out sideways in people's lives and people's decisions?
Well, I'd like to say the trauma is not what happened in the past. The trauma is how certain experiences continue to be re-experienced in the body today. So in some ways, the past is almost irrelevant, except to the degree that your body keeps reacting to current experiences as if you're back there. And that's why the story about your almost drowning as a kid is of some interest, but the real interest is, how are you doing with swimming now?
Surfing.
It's the only thing that I care about.
Right.
If you enjoy swimming right now and you enjoy taking a bath, you're just fine.
Yeah.
So we're not looking to treat somebody who had a trauma by opening up that whole bag of difficult times. If they are functioning well and it's not repeating, or if it's not playing out in their everyday life, just leave it behind and don't try to understand it.
Some people like to understand their past. Other people don't want to understand their past. The only judgment that's relevant is, how are you doing? And if you have loving relationships with people in your environment and you're enjoying what you do, have a good life.
Your specialty is trying to detoxify the trauma that's inside of us.
Well, to some degree. Who gets hurt? Trauma is usually about secrets. Very oftentimes it's about things happening to you that you're not able or allowed to talk about. And that oftentimes has to do with your relationship to your caregivers, because you depend on your caregivers. And if your caregivers put you down or freak out on you or become very violent, a kid is unlikely to be able to talk about it and to say, you know, I really love my dad, but I'm so scared of him. Or I really love my mom, but she starts screaming when I start doing minor things. And so you carry these imprints and you cannot really talk about it. So if you've read my book, it's called The Body Keeps the Score. That's really what it's all about, is that your body may become the storehouse of intense emotions. And trauma is lived out in heartbreak and gut-wrenching experiences that sit in your body. And what's important also is that telling the story about the past probably helps you to now understand why you feel so badly. But telling the story about the past doesn't necessarily undo the past, because it's really your body that gets reset by that traumatic experience. And the treatment of trauma is making the body feel safe.
Hi, it's Ted taking a second to remind you that The Genius of Wellness is your place for interesting podcasts, tips for healthy living, and doctors who provide a personalized approach to healthcare. You can find it all, plus schedule an appointment, at thegeniusofwellness.org. Now, back to our conversation.
Bessel, you've brought up so many things. You've introduced so many ideas. I think, one, it invites this idea that what a parent might think is really an innocuous or insignificant thing that they're doing can actually be a very significant thing to a child.
I would imagine that if an impartial observer would observe the interactions, that they would be able to see what's going on. And you see this kid shutting down, or you see this kid becoming dysregulated, or you see this kid becoming clingy. So it is acted out by behaviors, but behaviors that parents themselves, because they may be blind, cannot observe, and that kids cannot articulate because they just have bodily reactions.
Well, people who suffer from trauma often do it individually. And when they look for help from friends or their support group, very often society wants to forget it. They basically say, get over it. It happened 40 years ago. That's not always the most healthy way of getting over it.
That's really a misunderstanding, which I was writing an article about it. We created the diagnosis of PTSD for political purposes and connected it up with the past events. That's so where PTSD comes from, is from the Veterans Administration, where we had to explain to the government these guys are messed up because of the war. And we made it into a memory diagnosis. But people don't come for treatment because of their memories. People come for treatment because something is bugging them right now. They're afraid all the time. Or when they get close to somebody, they shut down. Or they get very angry about minor issues. Or they feel that their heart is frozen. People really very rarely come for treatment because of something that happened to them in the past. It is the therapist who connects their symptoms with the past. Say, oh, you feel so upset because you drowned as a kid. Or you feel so upset because somebody molested you as a kid, you go, and that's why you feel so upset right now when this occurs. But it's the therapist who makes that connection. It's rarely the sufferers themselves who make that connection with the past.
So what's the worst trauma then?
The worst trauma is to be abandoned by the people who are supposed to take care of you.
In past work I've done with children who have anxiety disorders or PANS and PANDAS or even autism spectrum, I think the parents were very loving and they were doing everything in their power to create a safe environment and to try and just understand how do they help that child feel safe, but then the child is still acting out in ways in which they don't know how to actually make them feel safe. So what are those factors that a child who may be confused about, you know, being scared or being safe or what's going on, how do you make an environment that they will anticipate is actually a safe environment for them to be in so that they don't develop trauma?
Again, so the way you frame it is not the way I would think about it. For one thing, you're talking about anxious children. Kids can become anxious for any number of reasons. It may be a food allergy, or it may be because they're autistic, or because they have sensory integration problems, or they have a hard time filtering out loud noises. You need to be really a very good diagnostician before you decide that it's because of this or that. And so you need to really start with very precise observations of what makes this kid feel scared, what makes this kid feel safe, how is this kid doing with sensory integration, how is this kid doing with autonomic arousal, when does this kid feel safe, doesn't this kid feel safe. And so a lot of problems may not be trauma related. They may be just intrinsic sensory processing issues.
So you mentioned the worst trauma is abandoned by those who you trust the most. What is the way for a person to get over that type of trauma?
You're still thinking about it in terms of events, and I don't think in terms of events. I don't think in terms of stories. I think in terms of people's reactions. What's going on with this person? Are they frozen? Are they scared to eat? Are they scared to go into a room? Are they scared to talk to people? It all happens right in front of your face in some ways.
So can you take one of those situations and tell us what a treatment is?
I first need to know what's going on. Huh? So if somebody is anxious, I need to know the conditions under which they become anxious. It's extremely complex work. If somebody is extremely anxious in my office, I would not ask them to recall the last time they were safe, because that's all dependent on state-dependent learning. And right. So when you're in an anxious state of mind, you cannot remember when you felt safe.
Right.
So everything is dangerous. So what I would focus on is what happens if, let's say, we tap acupressure points. What happens if we take a deeper breath and focus on our out-breath? What happens if you feel your butt in a chair? What happens if we make a sound together? So I'd like to create conditions in the room that shifts people's orientation somewhat. I think that's really where I start always. I start in the here and now with what sort of sound, body movement, breath, or sensation can sort of shift the state that people are in right now.
It sounds almost like a, if not mindfulness meditation, but mindfulness towards what sort of activities do you notice that actually will kind of undo the behavior or the feeling you have in those settings?
The issue of mindfulness is very at the core, of course. But it's very hard to be mindful when your mind is on fire. And so the biggest initial challenge is to actually make it possible to pay attention to themselves. And so that is, I think, the first challenge, is to see what makes it possible for a moment, for people for a moment to just feel, yeah, this is okay. When you play this tuning fork, yeah, that's a nice feeling. Or when I tap myself, yeah, I feel a little bit safer. When I take a deeper breath, I feel a little bit safer. It's really about the whole interoceptive system of the brain. In the neuroscience, we call it the midline structures of the cortex, which are related to your relationship to yourself and your self-regulation. That's the royal road to owning yourself, basically.
It would seem that adults would be dealing with it in a way of trust, security, safety. And that could play out in the workplace. It could happen in a relationship. It could happen with your siblings, that you tend to just be the first one to not trust other people.
Right. With early childhood trauma or other pre-existing issues, you become hypersensitive to the ordinary things that happen in life. You know, people aren't always nice to each other. People aren't always considerate. People aren't always patient. But if you are a traumatized person, you have a very intense reactions to the stuff that happens to you. And so the big challenge is how you calm that organism down so it doesn't get so easily hurt, insulted, and upset.
What do you think about energy tapping and resetting the tuning fork of their responses, things that make them anxious?
So there are multiple methods by which you can do it. So tapping is one of them, tuning forks, yoga exercises, qigong exercises, singing movements. They all have the potential of sort of changing your relationship to your own internal system. What's also very helpful, might be helpful, for example, is to use what both Norman Doidge and Stephen Porges talk about, using certain instruments that make your ears less sound sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
You feel better integrated in terms of your filtering system. Very helpful also might be to do sensory integration exercises where you can feel pressure on your body and lack of pressure on your body, and to really explore what does your body need to feel calm and safe.
What was that music I was listening to? I just was the...
The singing bowls.
The singing bowls. Oh, yeah. My goodness, those are just amazing.
It may be great for some people. It may drive other people crazy. I'm just writing an article about this, actually, that we need to be much more precise in our diagnoses to really say, so what is bothering you? What is it about that particular person that really you can't stand? And what can you do? Is music helpful? Is movement helpful? Is taking a breath helpful? Is a particular yoga stance helpful? Is tossing a beach ball helpful? To really get exploring with yourself how your body can be helped to feel safe. One size never fits all, and one prescription never fits all, except that you need to learn to observe yourself. And you need to learn to find what helps you to deal with heartbreak and gut-wrenching sensations.
Do you find that there's any one particular modality that you find is more broadly useful with a lot more patients than others?
It depends on what's going on with the person. Eye movement desensitization, which I actually have done a number of sort of core studies in, is extraordinarily helpful if you'd suffer from flashbacks and nightmares. But because people tend to be somewhat careless, you say, oh, why don't you just try EMDR? No, EMDR is helpful if you suddenly feel as if you're getting molested, raped, or assaulted. Then dealing with that memory to calm it down is very effective. And EMDR can be extraordinarily helpful. But you don't use EMDR when people are always upset or are medically ill or have stuff, sort of as a general treatment. No, it's a specific for a treatment for a particular problem.
All the modalities you're talking about, how do we bring that into the therapeutic model for medical school physicians? I'm actually seeing less understanding of that with the new graduates.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems in medicine, of course, where everything gets mechanized and we don't get to know people in details. It's a very alarming situation that we're supposed to make people's symptoms go away in 7 minutes. I have a new doctor who I've now met twice for 7 minutes. He doesn't have a clue of who I am. I said, but I have to bill you for 7 minutes, and I'd have to bill you more if I see you an additional 7 minutes, but I really don't have time to come in to get to know you. So there's a lot of things that are really very, very wrong in our post-capitalist society, where everything is measured by the number of minutes and how much profit is being made by stuff. I was asked by the dean of my medical school to deal with the fantastic burnout rate of physicians. It says, why don't you do some nice yoga with them and they feel much better, but we cannot change the system. I said, but I'm sorry, you have to change the system. That's why people are burning out. And as long as you cannot have a relationship with the people you treat, you are going to feel terrible and you're going to feel dissatisfied when you come home. We really need a revolution. We can have all these little things that we can do, but basically, if everything is measured by how much money particular people are making, and that's the only value of worth, all these symptoms that we're dealing with are going to occur.
Well, doctor, you gave us a lot to think about because you gave us so much information. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to The Genius of Wellness. If you like our podcast, do us a favor. Share it with your friends and family and write a review on this podcast channel. It'll help more people find us. The Genius of Wellness is brought to you by Hopkins Medical Group, serving patients in Greater Boston with a personalized approach to healthcare. Learn more at thegeniusofwellness.org. I'm Ted Canova. See you next time.